meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
We're back on the Short Coat Podcast. It is I, Dave Etler. I'm here with Colleen Sandhook.
Hi.
I'm here with Casey and Cleary.
They won't let me eat my yogurt on the show.
You poor thing, you. Dylan Todd.
Hi there.
And Lisa Weir.
Hello.
It's been a big week. I'm saying that just to pump things up.
It's always a big week.
It's been a normal week.
In medical school, I always try to lower expectations and then jump over them. So you always have to say, like,
it's been a really slow week.
It's been...
There was nothing for me to talk about, nothing for me to think about. Therefore, the show is kind of going to suck today. Sorry.
Yeah, listeners, you should just tune off your Stitcher.
This is very like Lemony Snicket, where he's just like...
It's reverse psychology, actually.
This book is so books. Tragic that you should stop reading right now.
Yeah, it's been... You guys just had a big exam today, a little foundations. What was it?
No, not you.
Wrong class.
What?
MOHD. MOHD class.
We still let me. Yeah. Mod 4.
MOHD exam number, like,
that would
42.
Be mechanisms of health and disease for those of you who are not in the know.
I love that people are always like, what class give an exam in? I'm like,
all
MOHD.
Of them.
It's MOHD.
Mechanisms of hate and degradation.
Ooh.
Of self.
A multitude of hungry dolphins. Isn't that what Sipla's wife called it?
No, I haven't heard
that. That's awesome.
Wow.
So we're all feeling pretty good, I think.
No, it was good.
It's the end of a week.
In case any of the course directors are listening, it's a great class, and I greatly enjoy it, and I simply loathe myself for not performing at the level that I want to, but that's normal.
Do you really feel like you didn't do... It was fine.
That's why it's pass-fail, so that you can, you know... That's the whole point of pass-fail, because, you know...
It's really life, though, if you think about it. You know, life is pass-fail.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
Everybody fails.
Honors.
Everybody dies.
Well, yes, ultimately. But you don't get honors or near honors for the things that you do,
yeah,
I guess.
You do. It's called a salary.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I don't actually like measuring your life that way. Don't measure your life by money.
I'm into a pass-fail. You know, I had an old friend who was bemoaning her lack of perfection. And I said to her, you know, why don't you just embrace mediocrity like I do? You know, like, it's so much more fulfilling.
Oh, yeah.
Run with it.
I'm sure a machine will do her job much, much better than she does in just a few short years.
You know, if you're...
People are getting really dark today.
I was listening.
It's been a long
time. Speaking of machines losing jobs, this is a random piece of information that will never affect your life after this. I was listening to a podcast this morning. It was not the Short Coat, but it could be after this.
Well, that's the end of that
she
story.
She did all that?
I did listen
How
to the Short Coat.
How dare you?
No, but, you know, it was about the inventor of the shipping container, because prior to the shipping containers, when you transported foods like bananas, you could only transport one kind of food because it had to be at a very specific temperature, and like other kinds of foods have to be at a different temperature, and so a ship would come with only one thing, and it was like really expensive. And then this guy made the shipping container and got super rich off of it. But because of the shipping container, a lot of people in ports lost their jobs, because instead of taking, like, because they didn't have to unload things, because that was actually why he made the shipping container, was so that you could just take the container from the ship to the truck or to where the train without unloading it. So a bunch of people lost their jobs, but he got rich, and we can now put multiple things on ship. So
but everything I learned about shipping containers, I learned from The Wire.
What?
I think I learned everything I know from the same podcast that Lisa listened to. Was it Planet Money?
No, it was 99% Invisible.
Oh,
no, cool.
Planet Money did a similar
one. I love that show. That's a good
show. So good.
Okay, yes. But I'll say this. I mean, initially, you know, especially from like the Luddite perspective, people losing jobs to machines, not great. But think about this. At some point, hopefully in the relatively near future, we're going to have enough things automated, enough things mechanized, that we can actually live more leisurely lives and do more of the things that we want to do. And especially in America right now, we're not embracing that. We're working more hours and doing more things, but they're not always necessarily purposeful or useful things. We're just doing things for the sake of doing things, working long hours because it looks good.
That's a thing.
It's very frustrating.
Americans are perceived abroad as being interesting for the fact that we work very hard and we're proud of it. And that's not bad. Yeah. And that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with being proud of working hard, but there's a really big focus on like the number of hours that you are physically behind a desk. And it doesn't always correlate, you know, the number of hours that you're at your desk doesn't always correlate to your degree of meaningful output. If that
one
makes
is
sense.
Definitely penalized for not being behind their desk.
Yeah, which is too bad because a lot of the big tech companies, like I know Netflix does this, Amazon and Google do this. You work to specific tasks, and you might end up working a lot of hours to do a lot of tasks, but you're not. You know, you're not paid by like the number of hours that you're present. You just show up when you show up, and as long as you're getting the work done, they don't care how many hours you put into it. So working more efficiently, I think, is the way of the future, and I think machines are only going to help with that.
I think the way of the future is going to be, it's already been depicted in WALL-E, right? Where everyone's on like basically just like a huge cruise ship, spaceship.
Okay, not that leisurely. That's too leisurely.
We'll
don't
just
do
all
that.
Become like very fat and infantile.
Don't do that.
Here's the other
that's like that taken to the lazy extreme.
Here's the other side of this coin. In fact, I think I was talking with Deep this morning about this very topic and how. You know, he was saying something like, you know, I want to be, he was being very ambitious at this particular moment. And he was talking about how, you know, I want to be like, he was quoting Steve Jobs at me about how, you know, or something like that, about how we should do things in a certain way. And basically what it amounted to is always, you know, follow your thing and do something like that. And I'm like, look, the problem with these sorts of advice is that they always come from people who are at the top.
Yeah,
of their games, people who can actually say, you know what, I'm going to work 4 hours a week, and you know that's the way to live.
Mm-hmm.
There's this famous four hour work week guy. Have you heard of this thing?
Yeah.
Like I don't know. I don't even know what it is. I didn't even look at it because it's all bullshit.
Sounds irritating.
It's all bullshit.
I was gonna say, that sounds infuriating.
I only work 4 hours a week, and that's the way we should live. Well, guess what, you.
Other people work their butts off so that one
what
person.
What does he do?
It sounds like
he
just
worked for 4 hours.
He's like a venture capitalist.
Oh,
or something like
that's
that.
Not a real job. That's a made up job. I hate. Oh,
and people like people
get me started.
And people at the top are always like giving out their advice on how to live their lives in this work world. And the in point of fact, I can't take their advice. You know why? Because mm-hmm. I have a boss who doesn't. I may have a boss who doesn't believe that. And I'm not talking about Jason because
he's chill.
Jason's all right.
Yep.
But, you know, like, nobody can take that advice. No other humans can take that advice. Oh, my God.
That's really the essence of privilege.
Admittedly.
I can tell.
Yeah, no, admittedly,
right
now. You
can't see Dave right now, but he is vibrating subtly.
Right now, it is a very particular type of job that has the potential to have some more of that leisure. It's people who create things or produce things. But, you know, I would like the caveat that it doesn't have to lead to laziness. You know, leisure time doesn't necessarily mean just sitting on the couch staring at the TV for 23 hours of 24 in a day.
Speak for yourself.
No, I know. I mean, people could actually be more healthy. People could go out and play sports or go for runs or go on picnics with their family.
If we weren't sitting on our asses all day behind a computer, we'd be a fitter society.
Or go play video games. But also, you know, part of that mechanization is that people who have the jobs that you have to be present for X number of hours, those jobs are going to start to go away and that'll hurt them for a while. But potentially we could shift to a society,
as far as I can see,
where that's okay.
No podcasting robot is currently in development, so I think we're safe.
No,
this
robot
is a leisure activity.
Can replicate my sense of humor.
That's
true
what
that.
You think.
Well, yes.
Lisa, have I done something to you lately?
No, I'm just saying robots are going to be smarter than we think. Like,
they're going to be so funny.
People study the science.
So
people
funny.
Study the science of humor, so I feel like you could program a robot to be pretty humorous.
There's
going to
be like Robo Larry David in the future, and he's just going to write all the shows.
Speaking of which, is it my imagination, or does Bernie Sanders sound exactly like Larry David?
Oh yeah, totally. Maybe it's just old man voice.
He sounds exactly like what I want to vote for.
I'm just, you know, I mean, I like the guy. I'm just having a little trouble imagining him giving like a big speech in front of, you know, Congress or whatever, and being like, so, you know.
Yeah.
Dave, don't be so shallow.
I'm sorry.
He's a pretty good speaker.
I think the New York Times was the one that recently had an op-ed on a New York accent helping you get ahead.
Yes,
oh, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump.
Do you have stock in the New York Times? What's going on over there with you?
I just have a subscription and I need to get my money's worth out of it.
I love that when you spend the money on something and then like it makes you use it.
Exactly. No, I used it. I used it anyway. So I originally got a gift subscription for Christmas last year and I fell in love with it. Like I always liked the New York Times, but I really hated that they had the 10
Except for like Maureen Dowd, it's mostly good. Mostly good stuff.
10 articles a month. I would hit my 10 articles in like a week, maybe a week and a half.
It's funny.
And so I got it.
Then.
Yeah, exactly. And as a college student, you get it half off. So it's only like $7 a month. So I don't have Netflix anymore. That's not true. My boyfriend has Netflix. I don't pay for my own Netflix anymore.
Oh, I see.
But I pay for the New York Times. And so
well, you seize the moral high ground
people,
there.
I did. Different people bring different exactly. things to
no,
read.
So I read the New York Times every morning on my bus ride to school. And that is, and then I come to school well-informed. And I feel like I can talk to people who are not in med school about things that are not med school.
Oh, that must be a nice feeling.
You are a paragon among slouches.
We should take a page out of your
New
York Times.
Tell us about your 4-hour work week.
Speaking of which, I want to know if... So I read this article written by a Stanford student who's meditating on whether in the bubble of academic medicine that you guys are in, students get a real view of what being a doctor is like. And... So he claims that at medical school, he doesn't see the burnout that stats say is a big problem in the profession. And he claims that academic doctors, academic medical doctors, oh my God, wear lots
no
of...
No more coffee for you.
Yes, wear lots of hats.
You off.
So they're like researchers and clinicians and teachers, so they never get bored. But he worries sometimes that that means that students think burnout is this sort of abstract idea that will never apply to them. I'm wondering if you guys have any opinions.
If he doesn't see it, how does he know it exists?
Because we're told it exists.
I'm just wondering. I mean,
I think
if a doctor burns out, no one is there to see him.
Did he really burn out? I think you have to cultivate a very special and close relationship with someone before they'll open up about it personally.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, it's the way of the profession that people hide their vulnerabilities because it calls into question their credibility and their level-headedness and their judgment as a physician to show any type of weakness in their life.
Oh, and it starts in med school. We all do
oh,
that.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
No yeah. one admits to failing a test. No one admits to just wanting to go home and watch Scandal all night long and not study for a neuro exam.
I don't know who you hang out
animal.
With. That's all we talk about.
But that's true.
But, I mean, but in general,
yeah,
it's very true.
Like, people
you
just
wouldn't
don't.
Admit it to your professor, though.
No.
Oh, no, never. You really wouldn't admit it to anyone you don't know well in your class.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, no one listens to this podcast, so your secret is safe. But
we're trying
actually,
to break down that wall.
I only watched 10 minutes of Scandal last night, so
proud of you.
I know what that show is.
Don't start watching it.
Okay, I'm watching
it
all
will
the original.
Suck you in.
I'm watching the original Dragon Ball Z.
I mean, even on the 6 weeks of internal medicine that I did before I started grad school, I was kind of thinking about, you know, like, okay, if I was an internal med resident and I basically had to do a harder version of this rotation, like, I think I would just be, like, so tired. Like, just so completely, just kind of scraping by, you know? Mm-hmm. But just scraping by, I don't think is what patients want. And especially since residents provide a lot of the care. You know, I'm sure as you get more efficient, it gets better. But I know that first year of residency, it can break people.
You're scrambling mm-hmm. for that efficiency and you're not,
yeah.
you don't have the tools yet.
Yeah. So anyway.
Also in medical school, we don't have the same level of pressure as like full doctors do. I feel like there's a little bit more responsibility and like accountability placed on, not that we don't have any accountability,
oh, yeah.
but I mean, it's
sued.
A lot more stressful for people once they're out of medical school. And I don't think that has to do with academic versus non-academic. I think that's just the level at which you're practicing and the way that people
it's very field dependent.
Treat I mean, you. That too.
Primary care is, there's a reason why, you know, there's kind of not as many primary care doctors as there should be, because it is kind of exhausting. It's a very, you know, morally fulfilling profession, but it's also very exhausting.
And the pay's not great.
From what I've experienced so far.
We have some good news to announce. Did you know that?
What is it?
Oh, really?
We do.
Yeah, we do.
Aline Sanduk got into the MSTP program, the Medical Scientist Training Program.
Nice.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Clap near the mics. Well,
pat on the back from Corey Christensen.
Yes, thank you.
I can die now. That's what I wanted. That's really why I applied, Corey.
How did you get in? How'd you do it?
I asked a lot of questions and did my homework and
good advice
about
for
it.
A researcher.
Yeah. I thought about it for a really long time.
And you did research before you came to. You had a life before you came to college, or before you came to med school.
This is a type of college. Yeah, you know,
before you came to med school, you had knowledge of how that.
Yeah, I know how science works, and I wanted to do it for a longer time, and I think they agreed that I wanted to do that.
Keep you around. What I love about this, and what I love about MSTP students in general, is that at some point, you guys become such fixtures in my life that I can't imagine you are going one day to be gone.
That was going to happen regardless of what I did, Dave. Well, you know.
Are there any students who are like, wait, why are you still in my life? Like,
don't you have, why won't you leave?
Why haven't you graduated yet?
Well, there are MSTP students who...
Wait, what is MSTP stand for?
Medical Scientist Training Program.
There we go.
And it's a long process. I mean, you're getting your MD, and then at some point you pause and you get, you know, in your third year you pause and you get your PhD, which is a years long process. Mm-hmm. So you're basically what, almost doubling?
Over doubling is usually 4 or 5 years for PhD, right?
Yeah.
3 is a fast. 4 is average. 5 is. Also pretty average, actually. Yeah.
So these guys are just around for what seems like ever. And for instance, you know, shout out to my friend Nick Gregory, who graduated this past year. I never thought he would graduate. And it's not because he's not smart or wasn't doing what he needed to do or whatever. It's just that at some point, you know, and then they just are here. And I would, you know, go out for drinks and whatever. And it just is a part of my life. And then poof, he's gone. Mm-hmm.
That must have been really hard for you.
Where did he poof to?
Somewhere in St. Louis.
Oh, so. Okay.
He poofed 4 hours away.
Yeah,
it's not too bad.
Aline, you're going to poof someday.
No,
how often do people first, do people join the MSTP program after? Like, you know, there are a certain number of people that come in every year as MSTP. How often do people or how many people join after first year?
It seems like
Dylan did.
Yeah, so I joined just this... like spring, summer, early summer. And it definitely has a history of happening. So,
isn't there one?
There were three
or two
people?
Other?
Yeah. I think it's very unusual to have this many people interested, because there were, from my count, like 7 or 8 people who had expressed interest. And usually there's like one a year, maybe one every other year.
It's a big commitment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get paid.
Yeah, you do.
It does help.
If
I
had
really
to
helps.
Do 8 years of debt, I probably wouldn't.
I seriously considered it.
Yeah. But I've met people that are in their like 30s, 40s who actually came from the Iowa MSTP program, who did this kind of transition in. And so it has a long history. And I think they do a good job of picking people that fit in, that they're gonna mesh with the whole thing, because it's a huge, and you know, at some points I kind of feel like I don't even deserve it, you know. But
I have survivor's guilt,
imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
In a
weird way. Anyway, yeah.
But it's, yeah, I mean, it is a huge investment. It's true, and that's definitely not something to take lightly. And it's just preparation towards, you know, a certain type of career, or like a spectrum of careers that you would need a PhD for. And, you know, I don't know, the best piece of advice I got, well, I got a lot of best pieces of advice, but one that sticks out of my mind that pertains to our particular conversation right now came from one of the course directors who was an MD PhD alum, not from this program. But what he said was that you know, if you plan on getting the PhD anyway, then it's not really a delay. It just makes sense to do it now. But if you don't intend to do research and your heart's really in clinical medicine, strictly clinical medicine, then, and it feels like a setback to get a PhD, then you probably shouldn't do it.
Makes
yeah,
sense.
That's
a lot of medical students, they want to get going places.
Exactly.
And if you're more of a stagnant pool like I am, maybe a PhD is right for you. And you also like science, yeah.
Yeah.
And want to do it as a career.
I think you have to like science. Yeah.
I agree. Also, so this is something that I had to wrestle with when considering, because before I came in, I thought about applying for MSTP programs. And then I ultimately decided not to, partially because of the massive time commitment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I was like, I want to like actually get out into
That's
the world
totally
and do
fair.
Some stuff.
It's totally fair.
But another part of it was, if you have a professional degree, if you have an MD, you can do research. It's harder to do bench research. It's harder to do like a wet lab. So chemistry, genetics, that kind of stuff, you should seriously consider doing MD, PhD or MSTP program. But if you want to do clinical research or, I mean, clinical research is the big one, maybe some kinds of translational
epidemiology.
Yeah. Or even just case studies, like that is all stuff that can absolutely be done with MD only.
Yeah, you don't need to know how to do a PCR.
You don't need to spend that extra 7 or
you can get your
5 years, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah, or Master of Public Health. Some people do that too.
Yeah. For sure.
So yeah, so like, I don't know, if you're interested in science and research, like you don't have to be discouraged if you're like, 8 years, you know, think about doing clinical research.
Yeah.
And like our school has a research track, which is nice, and they facilitate you actually getting out into to do research. Like I did clinical research over the summer and it was great.
I mean, it's amphibians exist for a reason, right?
What?
Yes. I think I know where you're going.
Yeah, you know,
is it like the land water?
Yeah. I mean,
you are the amphibians of science.
There's a reason why they emerged from the history of life, that they're kind of bridging.
You turned from a princess to a frog.
Yeah. You regressed.
Can't I be a princess frog?
Robot make that joke.
Yeah.
Well, good. I congratulations.
Thank you.
We're happy to have
I'm
you around.
I'm extremely proud to have the opportunity.
That much longer.
Yep.
Speaking of science, how much there's sort of a debate right now in the science land. About how much scientists should check other scientists' work.
More than they do.
Well,
you just have an opinion about everything.
Yep.
You?
That's why she's a good podcaster.
Let the man finish, my guy.
I'm sorry.
That's why she's a good podcaster. Are you guys aware of the growing debate on the value of replicating old peer review studies?
Yes.
That's like a direct quote from the Wall Street Journal.
Especially in psychology, but I'm not allowed to talk about it.
So the article I read notes a recent new analysis of a 2001 study on antidepressants use in kids, which called for retracting the original study, and another that tried to replicate 100 classic psych studies. This has been all over the news too. 100 classic psych studies, it can only do so in 40% of them. Again, you know, the argument, I guess, would be, well, maybe those 40% should be retracted. I don't know. But anyway, the point is retraction, the debate isn't so much that science can be wrong or that, you know, studies can be wrong, but is retraction the right answer?
I think it depends upon what you believe is the base reason for not being able to replicate studies.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of reasons. One could be it's not true. Like it was just a false finding. It was one of those, you know, 0.05s that happens. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is someone falsified data or misanalyzed data, then probably should be retracted.
Misanalyzed
is the biggest one. And that's actually one way that this can help is people like opening up their data and letting someone else analyze it.
Yeah. Or poorly designed study.
Yeah, poorly designed study. Another reason could be that like maybe we don't have a good way of measuring things and people measure things differently and maybe it happens, but we aren't measuring it the same or we aren't measuring it correctly or measuring the right thing.
The issue of whether the people that tried to replicate the study were able to understand due to the way that the study was described, how it was done and
the problem
sort of
with that
the replicability.
Yeah. I think that's That's an excellent point. Sometimes the problem with that is that the only other person who understands your work at the same level that you do and would be the optimal person to double check your work happens to be a competitor. And maybe you don't want to reveal your work to that person because, you know, getting scooped does happen in science.
I think that's sad, though.
It is sad, like, and I wish it was different.
We shouldn't have competitors. Like, we are all going for the same thing. We are all going for the advancement of science.
Grant money.
Grant
bragging,
money.
Bragging
grant
rights.
Which is unfortunate, yeah. Yes. And that's why it happens. Like, we're all going for the advancement of science, but unfortunately, like, money is so limited, and academic research positions are so limited that you do. Like, you feel like you have to guard your work so tightly, and you can't let anyone else in because they might get your grant or they might get your professorship.
Here's an interesting tangent. Apparently the placebo effect has been getting stronger in America.
So what does that mean?
So they've tested, they've done like repeat clinical trials for drugs that were discovered and proved effective for like neuropathic pain. They found that actually now they're no longer statistically significant because our placebo has increased.
I have a question. Have you heard of the theory that the more you study something, the less strong the effect becomes?
And so
there's this theory, and I think they discovered it in like looking at bird migration patterns or something really weird, where they originally found this really strong correlation and someone went to replicate it and it was a little less stronger and they went to replicate it again and it just gets smaller and smaller the more they study it. So I wonder if it's anything like that.
Yeah. Well,
which is so bizarre.
The weird thing is that
I think that's called regression to the mean.
If you test these,
I think there's a principle for that.
Yeah, sorry. You're right. If you test drugs in different countries, one might be approved in one country and not approved in this like very suggestible population that has a high expectation for being cured by a pill, which is just mind-blowing, you know.
I think that says a lot about Americans and what we expect that the miracle of modern medicine
can do
for us.
He said that at the very beginning. Well, I wasn't listening.
It's my fault.
I don't know if you need more coffee or less.
Maybe it's the sugar industry.
It's clearly a conspiracy.
The article wonders, and this seemed like a reasonable thing. So is retraction the right answer? Maybe not, as Lisa addressed. But why couldn't we just link, now that we have links in our lives, why couldn't we just link to the, you know, at the top of the study that is wrong or whatever, link to the new study that points out that it's right? That way, the information, because if you retract a study, essentially that information is gone.
Right.
Or I don't know.
It's also very shaming to the people who published it, even if they didn't do anything wrong and they just got one of those weird happenstance significant answers. Like, that's,
well, yeah, I mean, it depends on how you go about
it's harsh.
I mean, I guess you could have different reasons for you know sort of doing that linking, but you know, if you link from the old study to the new study and then you say, well, this study was retracted because the design needed some work or, you know, whatever. Here's the new study. That way the information doesn't get lost. It's still there.
But people will still know what that means, I think. No,
Dave, I think that's a lovely idea. We should do that.
It would be great if we were all rational.
But you're full of crap.
No.
I mean, I think that's a good way to let the general population know. Like, I think as people who don't know science, when you just say retracted, they think someone lied or made up something. When maybe that's not true.
If you explain, then maybe
you're helping educate people that they're like, there are different designs that need different
things. Who outside of science sits down to read scientific papers, though? I meant for the scientific community.
I don't know. I read scientific papers when I was in junior high.
Yeah, and you're a medical student, honey. You're not the norm.
That was what I read at the breakfast table.
One thing that bothers me in the public consciousness is that, you know, the public views the retraction or the, like, the retreading of scientific territory as somehow reflecting that science doesn't work.
I think it degrades trust in the process.
Well,
that can be fixed a different way. That is the product of people just not getting how science works. They don't understand there is no truth. There's things that are truer than others, but there are no definitive answers in science. It just doesn't work that way. But people don't find that very palatable.
Mm. And but also there's the whole idea that plays into the whole idea of failure and how, you know, is you know, when you don't get the answer you want, is that failure?
Yeah.
Or is it just another kind of success? You know, you eliminated.
You're learning. Mm-hmm.
That's why I think it's unfortunate that it's so hard to get negative results published.
Yes.
Because I feel like that's very important information.
It is important.
But people seem to only think that positive results are important.
In fact, that's
unless you're like showing negative results against someone else's positive results.
Yeah, but it also it leads to a huge bias then in the literature to all these positive results, and some of that bias of people getting you know, sort of the very edge of the bell curve, the one thing that worked. You know, if 30 people do the same experiment, only one gets it to work, that one person is the one that gets published. Mm. And so then that like gets absorbed into the common consciousness. And if it's something interesting, news outlets just jump on it like it's fact handed down from God. And
gospel.
That's just ridiculous.
Although there is a push, I believe, to kind of against that in terms of like registering clinical trials that are funded, and you have to register all of them, and you have to report your data regardless of whether it's published or not. So at least people, there is a place you can theoretically go if you know where to go and find that this trial happened, they didn't find anything and it wasn't published.
Has anyone done a very hard Sudoku puzzle where there's just like only like two boxes filled in? One interesting thing about, you know, let's say 40 of the studies being able to be replicated is that, you know, if you imagine doing a Sudoku puzzle and like 60% of the things you're doing were wrong, it would be hard to complete a Sudoku puzzle. And yet somehow like science manages to learn new things. So I think that's one of the things that kind of showcases how durable the scientific method is. It's not a Sudoku puzzle where there's only one correct number you can put in every box. You can still learn some stuff. Yeah.
I was going to say that's part of being a scientist. It's a community that builds on, you know, it builds on itself. And so that part of your work as a scientist is to determine how much you trust the results of a different paper and then try it out yourself and then build on that knowledge by using that method to discover new things. So there is an inherent system that weeds out results that don't make sense or a process that just can't be replicated. People don't like to, sometimes they do waste time trying to replicate results, but they try it, it doesn't work, they move on to something else. So there is an inherent mechanism that addresses the problem you're talking about, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you get funding to replicate results? I mean, how does it
you don't.
Is that a thing?
It's hard to get funding.
Yeah, there are some, I think, that you can get funding. Sometimes.
I think,
I mean, do you go
like
to a particular like funding body and say, hey, the replicate results fund? And
no, I think there are funds that want to replicate. I don't know, unfortunately, what the name specific names of them are, but
that's okay.
They exist. But you wouldn't go to the NIH and say, like, hey, I want to replicate this.
They're not going to buy it.
Okay.
With that, I'm going to run away.
All right.
So have
good luck.
She's
going to
go poof.
I'm going to go poof.
Good luck.
Well,
the rest
just a short term.
Don't go to St. Louis. That's where all of Dave's friends
just
go.
Just say no.
After they
have fun, guys. Happy weekend.
Well, we are at the end of our show anyway. So thank you so much for tuning in, listeners. We'll just do this. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, leave us a review and some stars on iTunes or Stitcher. What did you think of today's show? Are we full of crap? Tell us at theshortcode.com, on Twitter, Facebook. You can use any of those ways to get in touch with us. But if you leave us a voicemail, I can play on the air by calling 347-SHORT-CT, 347-746-7828. That would be nice. Then I can play it on the air. So it'd be sweet. The show is made possible by the strange world we live in and a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine, student government, and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in a week. Oh, baby.